What?
All right, for the fifth time, welcome to our weekly live stream where we talk about beer and brewing and stuff and hopefully teach you guys some important lessons. We break this down with our Genus News, what happened to us this week, some beer news if there is any to talk about nationwide or worldwide, and then we also go into a style of the week, which this week's will be a raw lager because we brewed one and it's really good. And then we go into two discussion topics. Today's will be draft troubleshooting, making sure that your beers are pouring nice and crispy every single time and they're not over foaming, they're not doing some funny spurts and stuff like that. Then we're also going to be talking about why we like to overnight mash and why you should too.
For those of you that will be tuning in on the podcast, welcome to the podcast on this week's episode. So, yeah, let's get right into it. Let's do some Genus updates. What happened other than, I guess, what we just did last night?
So we started planning slash discussing phase two, season two of Will It Beer, thanks to a generous super chat from somebody to kick us in the hiney. So.
That is true. It sounds like we got a couple of contestants, I guess you would call them.
Yeah.
I almost wanted to say victims, but
I mean,
you know.
Either way is kind of right.
So we got our next brewers lined up for that challenge. So we just got to get a date together that everybody can meet up on and make it happen.
Yeah.
Otherwise, let's see, what else went on this week?
We put on a Rosé IPA.
Ooh, that is true.
That finally is done. We've talked about this a couple of times, but our Rosé IPA hazy style with a Cabernet Merlot must conditioning.
Yeah, it's like if a hop profile was labeled bubblegum and juicy fruit. It is very, very strange. Just on the aroma itself is a very unique beer. So, somebody said, no, we're not blue. Somebody says we're blue.
I can see us.
We're
fine. We look pretty normal. I mean, you don't, but I look pretty normal.
I never look normal. And then also, let's see, what else did we get? Oh, we got a big thing this week, actually.
I always have a big
pertaining to our food situation, right?
Yeah, so we actually got health department approved to launch our kitchen. So we are go to order everything and get our kitchen organized. We will have a menu hopefully done and up and running and operational by the end of the month, if not early October. The health department is approved. Apparently, I'm really good at filling out paperwork.
Yeah, you are. We'll have that going soon. So that'll be another fun little thing that we got for the brewery here.
Oh, blue is my favorite color. We're not blue, but I asked them what their favorite color was. Thanks, guys. At least people are conversing with us.
Okay, yeah, and I think
I don't know if I sound close enough now. Does this sound super crispy?
So that's what's been going on in our neck of the woods. And I think as for the rest of the country, I don't know. I haven't been paying attention.
The rest of the country is still keeping on.
All right, well, let's get into our beer of the week. Ready?
Beer of the week.
Boop, 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 boop. Beer of the week. Boop, boop.
How'd you like the high harmony that time? Was that better than the going low as I did, you know, do normally? So let me know how you like the adjustment to the jingle.
All right. So we decided to not actually choose a BJCP style this week. We are choosing a style that, I guess, did we make it up? I'm sure somebody else has done it before.
It's been done. I actually got the idea for it, I think, from an article that someone did trying to do a raw lager. It might have even been a Reddit post. Basically, the idea is to do a no-boil beer where you go straight from the mash into the fermenter and end up with a product that is crisp and clean as humanly possible, which normally in raw beers is very, very difficult to do.
So our style of the week is a raw pseudo-lager is what we're calling it. Mm-hmm. And because of exactly what Peter said, so this is a beer that's going to have flavor profiles of essentially like a light American lager, but fermented hot. And not boiled at all.
Yeah, so we doubled down on making this weird by not only doing it raw, but also fermenting with quike yeast. But we'll get into that when we talk about the yeast of the week. Let's talk about the strategy we used for this. Basically, it came down to enzymes. Lots of enzymes.
Lots and lots of enzymes. actually, I don't really... You and Tim did this beer, so...
Yeah. Sometimes we chat. Sometimes you hear what we do.
is that when you use all the Visco Buster and the OptiMash?
We've been using Visco Buster and OptiMash in most of our beers, but the this one we doubled back on that by co-pitching Clarity Firm with our yeast. Clarity Firm is a gluten reducing and also clarifying enzyme.
that it breaks down proteins and stuff that causes haze, including gluten, which is why it reduces the gluten content. And then we also used AMG at the end.
Oh, okay. So you brutified it.
Yeah, we brutified it and clarified it. And then also after that, we super clarified it with super clear, the kiesel sol and chitosan planting.
So there's basically nothing left of this beer.
Pretty much. Basically, we did a raw lager, which would normally be thick and rich and meaty, and then we stripped everything away from it as well as we humanly possibly could.
Okay, so let's talk about the hop additions on this then. Obviously, if it's, you know, kind of targeting something like a light American lager, they're not going to be, you know, anything crazy.
Right, and so there's kind of a couple of ways you can go about this. When I'm doing light American lager style, my first strategy is generally just to go hardly any hops and go a really high alpha hops. But on this style, we kind of wanted to maybe add a little bit of flavor to complement some sort of fruitiness we were expecting with the yeast. And so Willamette was the hop we chose.
Nice. Willamette's a classic. It's actually one of my favorites. So it is a daughter of one of the hops.
Yeah, and I think it's crossed with like either a Wild American hop or like Brewer's Gold or something like that.
This sounds right.
I want to say it's a Fuggles derivative because I always see Willamette. We didn't do any research before this because we were cleaning all night. I always see it substituted with Fuggles and Styrian Goldings, which is why I think it's probably a Fuggles derivative.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Anyway, it's a classic kind of old school American hop. Sort of in that same line of when you see cluster used in a lot of classic American beers. But yeah, fantastic hop. Seems to be really consistent from year to year, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Has a more mild flavor than, you know, even something like Cascade or Centennial. But works really, really well in any beer that, you know, you're not going to have, you know, huge hop profile or you're not going to have a lot of body to.
That's right. Overall, hops don't really matter in this style, but it was kind of another way to maybe nudge it towards a flavorful direction since we knew we were going to be stripping everything away from it.
All right, so let's go on to our malt of the week, and I did see the actual brew log of this, and it was interesting. So single malt, you guys just used 2-row.
Good old American 2-row, and there's a couple reasons for this, because when you're doing a raw lager, you don't necessarily want to add a lot of adjuncts. You don't want to do a lot of things that are going to build those bodies and proteins because you're just going to try to break those down anyway. So doing this style, we ended up going with just basic 2-row for a couple reasons. First of all is the low protein content. And then the other reason is it's relatively high in just sugars that are super accessible right off the bat.
Yeah, so I think this is actually a great example. While most weeks we come to you guys, you know, with some kind of crazy out there specialty malt from this maltster or that maltster, you know, there is a time and place to just use a really nice, you know, very high sugar content, low protein content, basic, simple, neutral flavored malt. And for us, that's from Great Western Malting. You might have a different maltster that's a little bit closer to you. But yeah, your basic 2-row, it's going to, you know, be highly modified, going to convert for you just fine, and really not add a whole lot to additional flavors, right?
Hoplist says, Willamette is a triploid aroma hop, with its heritage being primarily derived from an English variety of Fuggle and a Fuggle tetraploid. It is, shares the same pedigree with its sister, Columbia. Cool. Thank you for that, Frazzled Penguin. When we don't have to do research every week.
Yeah,
we can just ask everyone to do our research for us.
All of our viewers do it for us. That's awesome.
I'm glad that I was on the right track with Fuggles, though.
Yeah, no, that sounded right. I'm like, it's got to be one of those English ones. So anyway, that is 2-row is our malt of the week. As for our yeast of the week, this is kind of the fun part, right?
So we actually wanted to use something that we got a suggestion from you guys actually on a live stream several weeks ago, asking us about the new Lutra yeast that came out from Omega Yeast, which is supposed to be able to quike style ferment, meaning it's going to go hot and fast and still produce really crisp, clean flavors.
Yeah, and it delivered.
Yeah, really, at home.
So you guys, it was 80 degrees. It was really hot.
I think it was warmer than that. I want to say we we went in at probably closer to 90, and then it probably rose up a little bit in early fermentation and then dropped out and kind of conditioned around that 85. And then, of course, we crashed it and everything like we did after fermentation, like you would a normal lager.
Yeah, so really kind of crazy high temperatures for being, a beer that's supposed to have a really clean profile. Lutra from Omega Yeast, that is our yeast of the week. Very, very interesting yeast.
I condone it. I endorse it. And I believe we are going to be trying to use the Lutra yeast in a West Coast IPA in the near future. Yeah.
And it went beast mode through that too.
Yeah, it did not take very long.
Yeah, I'm curious how vigorous it will ferment if you actually did it on lower temperatures.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see if it still fermented the same cleanliness. But
yeah,
that was our first time using it. We were impressed, and we are going to be using it again.
All right. As for water profile,
and Matt is the pseudo lager. Thanks for the shout out. Thanks for letting everyone know it's super tasty.
As for water profile, generally on the soft side, but I would personally say, you know, go with whatever your native water is, just because that's going to add a little bit of extra kind of pizzazz, extra style to this beer, because it's really not a style. So yeah, you can really make it whatever you want. I mean, unless your water's like stupidly hard, then it might start tasting a little bit chalky.
I actually believe that we did not water chem this one. We have relatively neutral water here, which is kind of strange because we had very, very hard water at our old location, which is only 2 miles away.
It's weird.
But we have relatively soft water, and so we didn't even water chem this.
So there you go. So pretty simple beer. That is the, what is it? What are we doing? Quike Pseudo Lager? Quike Raw Pseudo Lager.
Hot and heavy lager. That's the real, the official BJCP style guidelines name. Look out for it in 2022.
All right. Well, let's get into our first topic for discussion. Or should we go into overnight mashing to start with?
Yeah, let's start with overnight mashing, because that's a little bit more on the beer side, the style that you guys like to hear about. And overnight mashing is actually something that we've taken to do for, I want to say, probably the last year and a half. So we did it even before we moved to this location. But now that we're running a full operational tap room, it actually helps us out time-wise. And so we've been doing a lot more overnight mashing in this location. And it seems to be working really well for us.
Yeah, ultimately, we take the concept of a 60-minute mash time and throw that out the window with basically every batch. I would say even the batch that we did last night, while it wasn't exactly overnight, we were trying to do something in between, and we mashed in, and it probably went for a good two and a half hours.
Yeah.
And so ultimately what happens is you get better conversion from it, and you get a lot of you actually get a better breakdown of your proteins too.
Yeah, so there's a couple things that you can do with this. First of all, on the better conversion, the simplest explanation of why this is because it cuts out a lot of the variability when it comes to water to grist ratio. Mm-hmm. So if you shoot your water to grist ratio a little bit too high, then the enzymes take a longer time between sugar chains to get to each one, and so it might not convert as fast. There is kind of a sweet spot between that 1.25 and 1.5 quarts per pound, but also if you go really, really thick, it can also slow down that conversion.
So this is going to help with that. One thing I will say that we do is we do recirculate our mash. So one of the things is if you don't recirculate your mash and you try to mash overnight, you're either going to have to have a very, very well insulated mash tun, one that hardly loses any temperature, or you're going to want to hook up some kind of a pump system, and ideally some kind of a heating system for it too.
Yeah, so what we do, and another reason why it's able to be a really consistent system for us, is we'll mash in super, super low, like sometimes as low as 130, which is in that protease rest. It can also break down beta-glucans at that temperature. And we'll do a very, very slow recirculation through a immersion chiller that we have sitting in basically a mash and boil. So if you've got an electric kettle or if you've got a hot water source that you can use, you can put your mash, have it recirculate through a heat exchanging coil in that, and then back over the top of your mash and slowly rise. And so what we'll do is we'll have it set to like 170 degrees, the mash and boil that we use, and overnight it goes from 130 to just a little bit under 170, like 165 by the time we get back. And it takes the entire time to do this. This gets up to pasteurization temperature, and it also runs through every single phase of mash temperatures.
Yeah, so that's how we do it. That's basically a RIM system for you. If you happen to have one of the all-in-one systems, the little, the mash and boils, the anvil foundries, those type of things, this makes it actually really easy for you, because all you have to do, set your temperatures and forget them. You can walk away. It'll hold those overnight. I wouldn't really recommend holding like a protein rest overnight. But
definitely not.
But in your kind of 150 sack rest range, the likelihood of anything getting in there and kind of doing nasty stuff to it is really low. So that's a pretty kind of safe bet to go with there.
Yeah, and we got one question that's saying, does it change the brew house efficiency? And the answer is yes and no. Basically, what it does is it makes a more consistent thing. It cuts out variables for you, and so it makes it so you can more consistently hit the efficiency that you're looking for, and it's always a higher efficiency. You can single infusion mash, and depending on how you sparge, you can get a really consistently high efficiency, but this kind of cuts out a lot of the variables and makes it very, very easy to get a really good efficiency.
Yeah, I would say that our efficiency boost is maybe a couple percent. It's not a lot. You know, really, really the only difference in efficiency you're getting is just the fact that you are able to kind of leach out a few more of those sugars from the grains that otherwise might stay within the grain capsules if you did a shorter time. But
And if you do mash in at 130 like we do, then you also are cutting out beta glucans, which means the flowability of your wort coming off of your mash is going to be really good. But like I said, we have pretty good processes before, so for us it doesn't change a lot. But if you're consistently getting, you know, 75 or below brew house efficiency, you might actually get a significant bump just by doing something like an overnight mash and recirculating from a low to a high temperature.
Yeah, especially if you happen to have a mash tun that's, you know, gets a lot of like hot or cold spots in it. That's really the beauty of it, in my opinion, is that those temperature spikes really even out throughout all that time. So you allow those enzymes to, you know, at one point or another get in there and do their job.
Yeah. Just received a donation from a friend of an entire bin of Cascade hops. I haven't picked them off the bin yet. Should I do a drying on them or just bag them and freeze them? If you plan on storing them for any significant amount of time, then you do need to dry them.
Yeah. If you can, though, use them fresh. You know, you get a nice little floral quality off of them that you don't get if you try to process them in any way.
Yeah.
And it's honestly the easiest way, because processing them is kind of a pain in the butt.
Or just buy a still and then steam distill out the essential oils.
There you go. You can do that too.
Which we have things coming from that right now that we'll put out in videos in the near future.
Yeah. All right. So what else do we have to talk about overnight mashing? I think really it stemmed from...
Part of it should be that you should get familiar with what each rest is doing. So consistently when we're doing overnight mashing, we are often using a relatively higher adjunct ratio. And so if you were doing an overnight mash and you are doing the entire step mash all the way through like we do, then and you're using just like base two row, for example, I don't think you'd get the same. I don't think you'd get a positive effect.
Yeah, it depends, because there is a lot of things that are going to convert super fast or just be so overly modified that you're kind of going to get what you're going to get in the first 30 minutes regardless.
Yeah, like Great Western Two Row.
Yeah, like Great
Perfect
Western.
Perfect for raw lagers.
Like Great Western Two Row. But ultimately what it comes down to is that mashing overnight can only do positive things. Even with Two Row, it's not going to hurt anything. So it's a method that, you know, people are afraid to do. People don't really utilize it enough, especially if you, say, want to, you know, brew. You got a busy schedule. Say you want to brew during the work week. You come home late. You know, you can get mashed in, go to bed, you know, brew, and then finish out your batch in the morning before you even have to go to work. So
yeah, it actually works out really well for us, because we obviously have we're open from 10 in the morning to at least 8 p.m., if not 9 p.m. every single day. And so it's really hard to stack on a 5-hour brew day at the beginning or the end of that on times where we can't necessarily be brewing during operational hours. That just has to do with how our system here works. On really hot days, we can't necessarily open up our doors, and let the entire place get super hot. And so we need to brew in off hours. Also, because there's so few of us that are working here, brewing in off hours kind of helps us solve our time issues. And so overnight mashing is...
And by time, you mean focus issues.
You're a focus issue.
That is true.
You guys understand what I'm saying, right? Give me a thumbs up on the likey button if you understand exactly what I'm saying.
All right. So just to finish this up, overnight mashing, only positive. And if you have any kind of all-in-one system, there's no reason not to. They make it super easy. If not, you have options like doing a RIMS, getting a well-insulated mash tun, and then also, you know, having some kind of system to get through a few of those mash steps, starting at, you know, a protein rest or a beta glucanase rest, is also a really, really good way to utilize that extended time period.
Yeah.
So All right. Well, shall we go into troubleshooting draft now? There is a ton of questions we always get about draft of basically my beer is not pouring right. How do I fix it? So
my beer is pouring consistently flat. My beer is consistently over foaming. My beer has like weird bubbles in the line.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it. And we're going to have to break this down, starting with the basics of draft setup. And then we're going to talk about some specific stuff, depending on things like what coupler you're using. If you're using a ball lock system versus if you're using a like a D system, commercial keg coupler, Sankey system. So let's start with general, the basics of draft system setup, and that starts with a couple things like line balance and temperature.
Yeah, so when you are trying to serve a beer, it is under pressure. That pressure is keeping the carbonation, your CO2, inside the beer, and then as that beer gets relieved of that pressure and as that beer warms up, that CO2 comes out. It makes all those nice aromatics for you. It makes little bubbles in your glass. But it's finding the appropriate balance of this is actually a lot more complex than people realize.
And it starts with the carbonation in the keg. This is important to understand because there's some people that will buy kegs from a commercial source, and that keg can actually come overcarbonated.
In fact, then, more often than not.
Yeah, it happens quite a bit. And the trouble with that is people think that they need to start messing with their line balance. They need to mess with their pressure or something like that. And immediately they turn either an overcarbonated keg into a consistent issue for their next keg, or the next keg might be undercarbonated or served low, or they'll continue to overcarbonate it because a lot of people immediately start with turning their pressure up for some reason.
Yeah, and this is definitely not the right way to do it. Your system will have an appropriate balance. So let's just lay it out for you right now. So it is a balance of the pressure on the system. So your serving pressure, what you have your CO2 gauge set at.
Which should always be set to the level of carbonation that you want your beer at. So a 10 to 8 range is going to be a lower carbonated beer, maybe some stouts. This is assuming 100% CO2 in your tank, by the way. We can talk about beer gas a little bit down the road. But if it's 100% CO2, a low pressure, a low carbonation on that tank will be 8 to 10. A medium will be 10 to maybe 13. And then 14 to a little, I don't go much higher than 14.
Yeah,
is really high beers like Saisons, wheat beers, some sours.
For the most part at 16 PSI, you are nearing that saturation point. So,
Frazzle Penguin says 45 is his common serving pressure. I totally agree with that. If you want all your beer to come out like soda.
So the pressure of the system, and then next you have the temperature of the system, because this actually affects the solubility of CO2. This affects whether or not that CO2 can actually stay in the beer after you release the pressure.
You'll be very frustrated trying to serve a Saison at 15 PSI if your kegerator is at 40 degrees.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is in Celsius. Well, you'll probably be mad if it's at Celsius, 45 degrees too.
Yeah, definitely. And then the last bit is actually the resistance of the system. And when I say that, I mean the resistance going from the serving vessel to the faucet to the actual tap that you're pulling. And this includes your couplers, your lines, and then the tap itself.
For the lines, that's the most common thing that people start with when it comes to troubleshooting. You do have to realize that there are differences in resistance with each line. And so, for example, the most common line is going to be vinyl. That's that clear tube that you see on most kegerators. And that is actually relatively high resistance compared to something like a poly line, which is going to be better at stopping like microbes from growing in there, better at preventing beer after beer becoming contaminated with the flavor of the previous beer. And it also is lower pressure or lower resistance. Sorry, that means the friction of the line, the ability of the line to slow down your beer, which means you need a longer length or you need something like a flow control faucet.
Yeah, so here is the catch to these three factors. If you change one, you actually change them all.
Yeah.
So if you change one, it changes the entire balance of your system. That's what most people don't realize, and that's where most people actually run into problems with their systems.
A common example of errors that I see people making is when their CO2 tank starts to run out and their beer starts to slow down, they think that the solution is to increase the regulator. What that does is when you swap your tank out and you don't change your regulator back, the next beer obviously becomes overcarbonated, which means it's going to be foamy.
Yep. So when you change the pressure, it means you're having higher carbonation. It also means that the beer is, if you increase your pressure, the beer is actually flowing faster. out of the faucet. So it's actually hitting your glass harder. That's causing more of that CO2 to break out. That's going to cause a foamier pour as a general result. So the other really common thing, I mean, I would say in general, people always come to us, they say, my beer's pouring foamy. And especially in the summertime, one thing that I almost always will ask people is, do you have a kegerator with a tower on it? And the reason I ask that question is because if you have a kegerator that has, you know, one of those metal towers and you got, you know, a faucet or two coming off of that, that tower needs to be actively cooled. And what happens is if it's not actively cooled, that beer within the tower is actually warming up. And like we said, you got those three factors, all of which need to be in balance. If your beer is warming up, now you've thrown that balance off. The CO2 is going to want to break out of that beer, which means that the first part of that pour is going to be all foam. And that's usually people that have issues and they're like, the first beer always pours crappy, but then the second beer pours well. And generally that's a cooling issue, and it's actually a very simple fix. They make aftermarket fans that you can install on your kegerator. They have a little tube that blows right up into the tower, and it circulates cold air up to the top and blows it back down.
Or if you have a custom-built system in a home bar where your tower or your serving area is slightly separated from wherever the beer is being kept cold, you have the same kind of option. You actually can recirculate cold air if you have something like a shadow box. That's what I do at my bar downtown. Or you can also run glycol lines, but that starts to get a little bit more expensive.
So I think the next very common thing that we see is kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. And people say, hey, I put this beer on. It was great. But when I started getting to the end of the keg, the beer was going flat.
And this is when we're going to talk about, first of all, the pressure being too low, or maybe they bought beer gas.
Yep. So beer gas is hopefully something that you never see in a home, in a sort of home situation, because your lines are generally going to be very short, usually 6 to 8 feet draws is all you're looking at, if not even shorter if you have a flow control faucet.
Yeah.
But under the commercial setting, a lot of places will try to sell you a product called beer gas. And what this is it's a mix of carbon dioxide and nitrogen. And I believe it is 70% carbon dioxide.
Oh,
70% nitrogen and 30% carbon dioxide. And what it means is that the partial pressure, the pressure of the actual CO2, needs to be much, much higher.
Yeah, so you see it in 70, 30, and 60, 40. Those are the two common blends that you see it in. And it's the same if you have a blender, that if you have two different, like a nitrogen tank and a carbon dioxide tank, they'll mix it for you in line. If you buy a blender, that's what that does. But let's say it's 70, 30. If your pressure is set to 10 PSI, that's just a really good relative math example, that means the partial pressure of carbonation is 3 PSI. And 3 PSI is obviously way too low for any beer to be stored at.
Yep. So I've actually seen this personally in multiple commercial settings. People basically came up to me and told me that exact thing. You go down, you look, and you go, well, you know, you're at 12 PSI. And you go, what are you running? Oh, it's beer gas. Of course. Yeah, that's got to be turned up way higher. And really the only situation that beer gas is appropriate is in a very long draw system, and specifically systems that are having to push beer up from basements.
Yeah.
Because you have that additional sort of head pressure when you're trying to actually push beer up, you know, 10 or 12 feet above where the keg is sitting. So at home, more than likely, unless you got a really crazy, awesome draft system, this is never going to be something you run into. So always make sure you're running pure CO2.
Someone says they found that ultra taps improve the laminar flow versus inner tap. And laminar flow was one of the issues that they tried to address, actually, when they went from inner tap to Nuka tap. So we've used Nuka taps a couple times, and I'm actually about to set up my bar downtown with the Nuka taps. So I'll be able to tell you firsthand with several pours commercially how I think that works. Just throw that out there. All right, so we've talked about what makes the carbonation too high. We've talked about what makes the carbonation too low. And we've talked about kind of in general line balance stuff that makes it so that you might end up getting a too foamy or a not foamy at all pour. Now let's talk about some specific stuff that we've seen just as general troubleshooting might come along. And a lot of this is going to have to do with areas where air might be getting into your line unnecessarily.
So this is almost always going to be from some kind of connection point. So this could be at the where the faucet connects to the shank, where the shank connects to your line, your beverage line. But more than likely, it actually is going to be coming from the coupler from your serving line to the keg.
Yeah. So if you're using a commercial style coupler, there's actually a middle port that allows beer to escape and go into your beverage line. And then right outside there's a gasket that separates the liquid from the air. And that air is where it's getting pushed into the keg. And if there is a leak between the liquid and air side, then the first thing to come out and up your line is going to be the CO2 and not the beverage.
So, yep. So this will cause kind of bubbles to break out in the line. It'll actually cause more CO2 to break out because those bubbles are there. And you'll end up with a consistently foamy pour, not just on the first one. So that's definitely something to check for. You should be able to actually look in your line if this is a situation, and you'll actually see the bubbles forming in the line itself. So it's a pretty easy thing to sort of troubleshoot and figure out what's going on. And then the fix for it is also pretty easy. Generally, it just means that gasket Peter's talking about has worn out, and it just needs to be replaced with a new one.
For general maintenance, all your gaskets should also be keg lubed semi-regularly. Keg lube is a silicone lubricant that is food grade, flavorless, and won't really affect the beer at all. But it'll help you get, first of all, springier gaskets for longer, so they won't dry out and start to crack. And then also it'll help create an extra little layer of stoppingness between the gas and the liquid. This can also happen if you're in a corny keg, though. So corny keg can also get gas breakout. Well, first of all, let's say gas breakout can also happen if your serving pressure or your line balance is set to a lower serving pressure than your actual keg pressure. So let's say your keg was carbonated at 2.6 volumes, which should be relatively like 14, 13 PSI, but your line is balanced to a lower pressure, or it's balanced longer, so it's gonna slow it down too much. That can cause gas breakout, and gas breakout will do the same kind of thing where you see bubbles in the line. But let's go on to corny kegs, because corny kegs is probably what a lot of you homebrewers are using. And there are a lot of ways that under those posts, there can be some things constricting that actually can cause air to get in too.
So yeah, under the post, a lot of times, not necessarily air, but CO2 breakout will usually be caused by some kind of obstruction within the post itself. Inside of those, there's little springs. If you happen to get a little like hot particle or something stuck in there, that's a really common occurrence that we see. And that'll cause that CO2 to break out as it's coming through, but not actually stop the beer completely. Another really common thing though, and usually this results in a leak, but occasionally it can actually result in basically sucking air in, is if your O-ring is either cracked, broken, or missing.
Yeah, and sometimes that can also result, both of those can also result in either gas or liquid leaking out of your keg too. We've had a lot of people have that issue.
Yeah. And again, so it kind of comes down to, just checking it. Replace them honestly regularly because they're so dang cheap. And then keg lube. Yeah, lube is your friend.
And fun facts about leaks, they are also a far-fetched weapon of choice. So this usually happens when you get that obstruction under your posts. This usually happens when you dry hop a beer, you get a lot of hot particles in your keg. And then you try to basically still force your beer out without proper settling or without some sort of filter between the beer and the dip tube. That's when I see a lot of homebrewers go, what's going on with my keg? And that's usually why.
Yep. And people are talking about putting it on the post. I will put keg lube on your post, Peter.
Yes, you will.
Had to go there.
Okay. I demand it.
All right. What else have we got? Bear with us here.
I think we've done pretty good so far for an entire live stream on the live or on the fly. I don't know if you noticed, but we don't have sheets in front of us. It's because while we were setting up, we were just kind of shouting at each other, what should we talk about today?
So let's see. What's another common thing that people will come and they need us to troubleshoot?
Did we talk about the faucet side? So we talked about constriction. Constriction is going to be the friction that gives you that slows down your beer from hitting the back of your faucet. But you can also get constriction or resistance in your faucet itself with flow control faucets.
So those ones are actually awesome. I highly recommend them if they fall within your budget. They tend to be a little bit more expensive. Thank you, Derek P., by the way.
Yeah, we're not sponsored by KY.
Oh, Jesus. good one. Good one.
Lubricant. All right. I think that's the lubricant you want on your O-rings, though.
All right. Flow controls. Focus.
Put on my post.
So flow controls have an adjustable resistance to them. So what you'll notice is if you ever look at them, they have a little lever or some kind of a knob on the side. And what that does is it actually adjusts. Wait, what?
Knob.
Really?
Now it's just everything.
So that's going to adjust the resistance of flow. And essentially what that does is we talk about line balance. And generally you'll have a certain length of line. Like I said before, 6 to 8 feet is what most people will have. It actually takes that and basically nullifies that. It means you could be running 6 inches of line if you want, and Peter,
that's your fault.
Or 8 inches of line for some people.
It's more like it.
and all you have to do is take that knob and you have to turn that down, and that'll increase the resistance of the system so that it mimics you running 6 feet or 8 feet or 15 feet of line. So these are actually fantastic tools to use. It also means that if you happen to be running secondary regulators where you might want to serve one beer at 12 PSI and another beer up at 16 and really push that, you have the ability to do so without completely changing up your system. Flow controls.
We had a couple questions higher up that I saw about specific beers and the balance between pressure and temperature. So someone was asking about for Hefeweizen, 14 PSI. What temp? 34. Yeah. So
yeah.
If you're up at that 14, 15 PSI, you want to be as close to freezing without getting to the freezing point as possible. That can be 32, 33. Actually, the freezing point of beer is a little bit lower. But sometimes your temperature reader on your kegerator or your refrigerator is off by a couple degrees. And so if it's saying 32 and it actually means 29, that could be an issue. But if it's true to temperature, then you can be right at 33, 34 degrees pretty easily with 14 PSI and get a nice high carb and still have the beer not come out too fast.
Yeah. And if you do, I know a lot of those beers are traditionally served warmer. They're actually served, closer to that 45 degree mark sometimes, even for like certain German beers.
Yeah.
Like Kolsch, for instance, right? And Kolsch is traditionally pretty highly carbonated, but also served warm. And what I would say is just serve it cold and let the beer warm up. Because it is going to be a lot easier for you to pull off if you do want to try to like actually emulate that. The way that they get away with it over there is they're going to have a lot longer line length, so they have a lot more resistance on the system, which is going to slow that pour down for them, and that's what allows them to pour something that's highly carbonated without it foaming up too much.
Well, you also got to talk about the glasses that they serve in. They serve in intentionally oversized glasses
because
they expect
too, yeah.
you to be pouring about half of that in foam and capturing all those aromatics right off the bat.
So.
True Hefeweizen glass, for example, has a skinny narrow waist and then a huge bulb on the top. And that bulb is where it captures all the aromatics, and it's not intended to be filled with liquid.
So that's one thing to consider is just, figure out whatever works for you. We generally, run everything as cold as possible. Our walk-in here is about 36 degrees. So that just helps everything pour smoothly and, in a more uniform way.
Takes the guesswork out of it.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, if we could put everything on, secondary regulators and, have each keg have its own temperature, I would go for it. If you want to sponsor me on, getting a walk-in that does that, then I will gratefully accept. But until then, for most systems, it's just easier to set it for, a colder than average temperature and then be able to turn your serving pressure down a little bit. Okay. What was the other thing? There's one last thing I was thinking of. Oh, there we go. So one thing for people, if you're watching this channel, you probably already know this, but a lot of people that really have no experience with draft systems, no experience pouring beer from a keg, will say that their beers are coming out foamy, and they're trying to pour them slower, but they keep coming out foamier. And the reasoning behind that is because the way tap handles are pretty much all designed is a sort of no-go situation. So you never really want to feather a tap handle. They're just not designed to do that. By doing that, you actually cause the CO2 to break out, and you'll get more foam as a result.
The one exception would be like if you have a true check style
handle. If you actually want to make foam too. Yeah.
And that's what a Czech style handle does, actually. They're the side turn ball valve handles. And those are designed, like, because a true Czech Pilsner is designed to be served in an oversized glass, too. A lot of, like, old world glasses, they fix their problem without the technology of a draft system. They fix their problem with glassware and serving faucets and other things.
So, okay. Well, I don't know. Is there any, let us know if there is any other things you want us to go over on draft. We would be better organized. So we apologize
for that.
We
probably missed some stuff, but I feel like we did an all right job.
So
completely winging an entire live stream, I think we did an all right job. Any tips for preventing ice buildup on the back of kegerators? Using temperature sets to 34, you have to have regular... first of all, you have to have good airflow. So make sure that you're not overpacking the kegerator. Yeah. If the keg is absolutely full, the kegerator is absolutely full with... you know, kegs and then other stuff, and it doesn't have airflow, you're probably going to get iced. And the other thing is you do have to have regular thawing sessions. Yeah.
I would set that up with, so Inkbird makes some temperature controllers that you can program different times on them. Mm-hmm. And what I would do is I would actually invest in one of those. They're, I think, $50 or something like that. Run that through the kegerator so that it basically runs a defrost cycle, so that it's going to be running for say 23 hours a day and then stops running for a half hour every day or something like that, or maybe an hour in the middle of the night, just to allow it to defrost. Most of them should be able to kind of self defrost, but might not be the case for all of them. So,
and if you only do that once a month, then you might have to, you know, have a lot of towels under there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I would say to do it on basically a daily basis. That's how our walk-in works at like 7 o'clock in the morning, every morning. It actually turns off. It's fancy enough that it even has heaters in it. So,
yeah.
Here's defrost
some questions
cycle
that we didn't get to. How often do you clean your lines and how do you clean your lines? How often varies on the commercial scale. It's really common to do it every 2 to 3 weeks. We pump such high volumes of beer through our faucets that yeast buildup happens relatively quickly. On the home scale, we usually kind of tell people it's a good idea to just clean in between every batch of beer. Yep. So if your keg takes, you know, a month, month and a half, 2 months to go through, just make sure that whenever you're cleaning that keg out, it's going to be full of PBW anyway, and you can go ahead and run that PBW through your lines, which leads us to the how. There's two main components of cleaning lines, and the first is the one that you should do every single time, and that is some sort of alkaline or caustic cleaner. So alkaline is going to be what PBW is. It's alkaline and it's an oxygenating, it's a bubbler.
Oxy-boost. OxyClean.
Yeah, it's OxyClean. It's scrubbing bubbles for your lines. You can also use strong caustics, anything that's high alkaline, pretty much anything that's going to be a heavy base will work to eat up any organic material, i.e. yeast, proteins, all the buildup from your hazies that you keep pumping through them, all that stuff, alkalines will clean that up.
And you have that weird little brown film that forms on your line, which is a pretty good indicator that you are overdue for a line cleaning if you start seeing that.
Yeah, mold, hopefully it doesn't get to that, but then, you know.
Yeah, no, that's bad.
Alkaline hits that up too. And then every third or fourth time that you clean, you should also run some sort of acid through those. So if you already use Star Sand for your sanitizer and you have that in your keg anyway, that's a good one to run through. What acid is going to do is it's going to start to clean up the buildup of calcium deposits.
Yeah. So yeah, any kind of mineral deposit that might be left over from that alkaline cleaning. And this is going to happen in everything regardless. It happens way, way more slowly than the organic kind of protein deposits, but it will build up over the course of a year or so if you don't keep on it. So every few batches of beer, it's a good idea to run either kind of a slightly heavier Star Sand, even though Star Sand's not the best. I would probably recommend more of like an acid cleaner number 5, or you can buy beer line acid cleaner specifically for that. So some kind of product that's a little bit more concentrated that's designed for it.
Yeah, but Star Sand does work. And if you do it semi-regularly, you'll be fine. It'll clean up enough every, you know, like I said, third or fourth time that you swap your kegs out. That'll be plenty to keep that line cool. Derek P says, opinion on Star Sand versus Iota 4 for keg sanitizing and purging. So Star Sand is the all-purpose sanitizer we use most often. Any bacteria that's going to get in your keg is probably going to be killed by Star Sand. I also like the fact that it is a true flavorless, meaning or a true no-rinse flavorless sanitizer, meaning if there's still foam in there, if there's still a little bit of star sand on the bottom of it, it's not going to really change your beer all that much unless there's a lot of star sand. Iota4 is the better disinfectant. It's a halogen disinfectant, and so it will kill more things. But if it's used in the wrong concentration or if there's too much of it in your keg, it's a really easy thing to actually get the flavor of the Iota4 into your beer. So I like star sand because it's a better, easier to use system.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, they do both work. Iota4, I guess the one benefit of Iota4, other than, yes, it is technically a more effective killer. I use it to sanitize my greenhouse pots because, you know, spores and stuff like that. But the one thing I do like about it is it's not slippery like star sand. I'm sure some of you out there have dealt with the classic glass carboy with the bung covered in star sand as you keep pushing the bung in and it pops back up.
Yeah.
So Iota4 is a little better for that. But at the same time, I think just the overall ease of use of star sand, you don't have to worry so much about, you know, getting your PPM just right with it. That's kind of the trade-off there. So either one is a good way to sanitize, you know, definitely better than bleach or not sanitizing at all.
PBW is difficult to get a hold of in Europe. I don't know of any regulatory changes, but anything you can find that's a strong alkaline, that's going to work. What's the common one? TSP, I think, is a common one that you should be able to get. That'll work just fine. What about sour lines? So sour lines, honestly, they're not going to affect your beer all that much, especially if you're serving everything pretty cold. If you don't pour beer very often, they might change the first couple draws of your beer, but then after you've drawn, you know, 6 ounces or something like that, the rest of your beer should pour pretty not soured.
Yeah.
That said, the easiest solution is just keep your sour lines with sour beers if you brew a lot of sour beers.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a good segue into any beer, not just sours. People think sour lines have to be dedicated to sours because they're going to infect beer. Generally, that's not the case. It's actually because the lines themselves will absorb some of the flavor. So really, that can be said for any really strongly flavored beer, and not just sours. And yeah, so either dedicate a line to that, or, you know, what I always say is, because lines are pretty cheap, have a spare line that you can kind of hot swap out with your hardware connections. And that way, you know, if you do throw a new beer on tap and you're like, oh, this kind of tastes like that last beer, you can swap that line out really quick and easily, and then whenever you have time down the road, you can always kind of redo all those hardware fittings.
So. Someone asks, how long can you store sour sand in a keg before you need to mix up some new stuff?
Ooh, trick question.
Yeah, so that it does the thing that's keeping it sanitary is the pH, and so as long as the pH is below, I guess the manufacturer says 3.5. I usually go somewhere closer to 3.2, 3.3, which is that's the mixing pH, and then obviously if it's not dirty. So if there's a bunch of cloudiness or the potential for it to be dirty in the line. That's
like the gob of hair that fell in the one today that we're like, nope, make a new one now.
I get star sand can be a little bit expensive, but it's really not worth the risk. Honestly, what we do after we'll use boiling hot sanitizer when we're sanitizing kegs. And what we'll do is we'll actually push the sanitizer out with CO2, and then we will high pressurize the keg, and then the keg should be good until we use it the next time.
So, yeah. Otherwise, yeah, it depends a lot on the water hardness, too, for how long that star sand's going to stay good for. I would just say if you, when in doubt, if it looks cloudy, if it's been more than maybe a couple days, just dump it and make some new stuff. It's not worth, you know, ruining your beer over, you know, 25 cents.
Yeah. And somebody did just say that if you use distilled water, or even RO water, it will make the star sand last a lot longer, because the mineral breakout is a big part of what makes star sand cloudy.
And that is something that we actually will try to, we have lots of little spray bottles that we keep around the brew house. And when we can, we actually try to fill those up with some distilled water, just because then we don't have to worry about them.
Can you use PBW for a fermentation bucket? I mean, just to clean it. So it's not going to be your sanitizer. But if you have, like, let's say a film, or you've got some yeast stuck on the outside of the fermentation bucket, PBW is a good way to get that eaten up.
I would recommend kind of giving it a quick soak afterwards with some nice hot water, just so that you pull any of that kind of flavor out of the pores, because plastic is going to be a little more plastic.
How much beer do you need to drink a week to make kegging worth it? If you only have a few pints a week, will it be more of a hassle? Kegging's always going to be easier than bottling.
Yeah.
It's just a bigger upfront cost.
Yeah, it's so convenient. You'll probably actually find that you drink more. if you keg your beer, you'll end up drinking more pints. It's just the nature of the beast because it's there. It's readily available.
Yeah, I think you just need to make the commitment to drink more.
No, it does, actually. Going from bottling to kegging will make the whole process more enjoyable, mostly because it saves you time and makes it easier. And, you know, when your buddies come over, it's not like the whole thing of, here, well, let me pour you this beer, because you got to kind of leave the yeast in there, and they're kind of looking at you funny. It's like, oh, yeah, go take a pull off of my kegerator. So, all right.
Get friends to come over.
Yeah, I think that's what they're talking about, kegging. Yeah, one keg versus 48 bottles. There you go. That's it in a nutshell. When it comes to, you know, cleaning and sanitizing, that's by far the biggest benefit of it.
Yeah, there are some benefits to bottling too. There are beers that'll taste better in bottles. A lot of beers that are gonna be traditional cask beers where they came from usually taste better in the bottle. Bottling can also, the secondary fermentation of bottling can also eliminate some off flavors that can happen. Let's say you get your beer into the keg a little bit too soon, or it just finished fermenting, or it goes through a temperature spike or re-fermentation in the keg before cooling down. You can get things like acetaldehyde or diacetyl or something like that stick around in the keg because it didn't have the time to go through that secondary conditioning phase. So there are some risks to kegging. Overall bottling, I think, is a little bit easier to be consistent on, but it's really not hard to be consistent kegging too. And there are beers that taste better in the keg as well. IPAs being probably the number one, like West Coast style IPAs, I should say.
Sounds good. Yeah. And by the way, we are just going on a general questioning now. We kind of transferred into that with
transitioned into the hot water.
Words are hard today without really letting y'all know. So throw your questions out there. I see another one from Hendrick, and he is wondering when the best time to filter wort/beer would be. Would it be pre-fermentation, post? He said he's always constantly battling with debris in his beer.
A general easy thing to do is just get a strainer and then filter between your boiling kettle and your fermenter. Just a fine mesh, or not fine mesh, but like a double mesh strainer is a really easy thing to do. It's going to, if you don't already have an oxygenation stone or a way to oxygenate or aerate your beer, it's going to help do that because of the extra contact splashing, basically.
And it kind of depends on the debris too. I'm wondering if
you want to get a lot of the hops out there. A little tiny bit of the like protein breakout can actually be good for your beer.
Yeah,
because it'll help other proteins coagulate and bright up a little bit faster. But
yeah, that I'm also thinking the debris that he's getting is actually probably from yeast, which just that could be a, you know, if you're bottle conditioning, you're always going to have that in there. It just means you need to, you know, pour the beer a little slower and kind of watch out for that. Otherwise, I mean, if you don't want to filter the yeast out if you're bottle conditioning.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get conditioned bottles. Yeah, you can buy 1 micron filters. They're kind of pool filters if you
yeast
keg.
Yeast will be a little bit bigger than 1 micron.
Yeah. So you can do that and you can filter into the keg. I've done it before. It works. It's a giant pain in the butt. And
well, it's only a giant pain in the butt when you have to filter, you know, a whole barrel of it.
That is true.
For 5 gallons, it wouldn't have been that bad.
Yeah, actually, that's okay. For 5 gallons, it wouldn't have been that bad. But, you know, it is an extra step. Those filters,
extra things to clean.
Yeah, generally don't last too long. You're probably going to have to, you know, throw them away within a few uses. So, yeah, it's just kind of one of those things. It's like, how worried about that are you? So,
yeah. On cleaning your taps, do you just use hot water? Yeah, we use the hot water with both the alkaline that we run through the taps and then also with the acid. So both of them we combine with hot water to run through.
Yeah, we really hot water. We heat it up in one of our little mash and boils we try to get up around pasteurization temperature, 160, 170 degrees.
Because the lines can handle it, so why not?
Yep, so and that's going to make sure everything in there is dead. And honestly, it helps things kind of work pretty well, even though it's above what some of the recommendations are. I've never seen a problem with it.
Off subject, but what about using oak chips or chunks if a barrel is not optional? We use that all the time, but you have to understand that they do different things. Oak chips or oak chunks or oak cubes or staves, they all have different surface areas and different fracturing, basically. So the type of cracks that's on an oak chip, there are a lot of them, and also the surface area of an oak chip is very, very high, meaning you get a more intensely woody flavor in a very quick amount of time. So they don't actually age quite the same way as a barrel, where the fractures are relatively minimal. Usually the barrel's wet and swollen going into the your beer, meaning it's really just the surface you're getting. And over time, when the barrel expands and contracts, that vanilla flavor kind of comes to the surface, and you get less of the barrel flavor and more of the sweet flavor that comes from the charred barrel, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you just have to play around with it and start small and work your way up. That's what I can tell you from experience. It's really easy to actually overdo, especially something like chips, because of what Peter's talking about with that high surface area. If you want something that's going to emulate a barrel a little more accurately, I would actually recommend something like the beer sticks, which are a little bit larger piece of wood. Yeah. Still a lot of surface area on them, but if you leave them on the beer for a long time, and when I say that, I mean you know, several months to a year even, then you will be able to better emulate that sort of kind of barrel conditioning effect.
And if you want to get super technical, you should actually swell or hydrate those sticks before using them.
So there you go. Yeah. How far down the rabbit hole do you want to go?
Racking into general questions. That's what we should have said.
Yeah. Good one. Good one.
Good one, Jeff. Talking about clarifiers. So Frazzled Penguin uses gelatin. We use super clear. Gelatin works too. We used to use gelatin, but we use super clear, which is a combination of kieselsol, same thing as Biofine, which is vegan friendly, and chitosan, which is not vegan friendly, but we use it.
Yeah, no, we've had we've used gelatin in the past. We've just found that the two part is very, very consistent, much more consistent than the gelatin was. So.
My problem with kegging is I can't empty them fast enough to keep up with the batches right now. Living alone with three corny kegs, need people to dump beer on. Yeah.
That sounds like a personal problem.
I think you really just need to make a beer for every meal. Like, you got to start making your breakfast beer, and then your lunch beer, and then your dinner beer. Your dinner beer and your nightcap beer. So your fourth one will be like that high alcohol right now, I'm ready to go to sleep. Your breakfast one will be a little bit lighter, maybe some maple and some bacon flavor in there, but...
Yeah.
If you just revolve your brewing around everything you consume.
You could scale down your batches a little bit, too. You could always do 3-gallon batches. They're almost more of a hassle than anything else. But
a lot of people we know actually just do a combination. So I have a friend that does a lot of like sour batches or like bigger beers, like more unique beers. And all those, he 100% bottles, usually in 750 mil. And he'll wax dip them because he gets fancy. But then any of those light drinkers, like a... session beers, blondes, most IPAs, that goes right into a keg and gets put on tap. So a good balance of kegging and bottling, I think, is a really fine way to do it.
Yeah. We got Brandon's asking, how long is it safe to leave beer on a dry hop? That kind of depends on the hop itself. So nowadays we have a lot of these sort of lupulin powder type hops. And those ones you can more or less leave it on there indefinitely. With that said, I mean,
you're still going to lose some aromatics.
Yeah, you don't want to, you don't want to make a really awesome hazy IPA and then just let it sit on hops for 2 months. That beer is going to be ruined by then.
Frazzled Penguin has a good answer. Leaving it on over 5 days is generally when we say 5 days is kind of the maximum. A lot of ours will actually try to get from dry hop into keg within 3 days. But again, it kind of depends on how you're dry hopping. If you're bagging your dry hops, that's going to lower the risk of grassiness, but also lower the contact of hops. So you get less utilization. We like to throw our hops straight in. That way we can maximize the contact if it's in one of our conicals, and we can actually use CO2 to turbulate the beer and get that a little bit more soaked in. That's a word. I'm using it.
We're using all kinds of words today.
You know, I am very... tall.
You got to get that contact area. Yeah. I know.
Maximize the hops and then get it into a keg within 3 days.
Yeah. I saw, where was that? I think that was down at Rogue actually. And I even asked them, they had a really big pump hooked up to one of their fermenters, and I was asking them what they were doing, and they said they were dry hopping. So they actually will circulate their fermenter when they're dry hopping. And I'm guessing that allows them to do it a lot quicker, probably within a couple days, and getting the most utilization they can out of their hops.
A lot of big scale breweries will do that not only with dry hopping, but they'll do it during fermentation too.
Yep.
So they'll actually try to keep that yeast in suspension, get that beer out and fermented and also clean as fast as possible. And they use the same pump system that they were circulating their beer with during fermentation during the dry hop because it can keep it as a closed system. I believe it's usually a diaphragm pump or a centrifuge pump, one of the two, centrifugal pump, one of the two. Yeah, so they're able to keep their beer moving, which maximizes that contact. Yeah.
No, the one I saw was just a regular old brew house pump. It wasn't anything fancy. So.
Well, you shouldn't use an impeller pump because that runs the risk of oxygen, at least on our scale. They might have a fancy one that doesn't do that, but... do we produce any unfined beers? Yeah, I would say a lot of our beers are unfined. Most hazy IPAs we don't fine. Sometimes we have to fine it. We don't want the yeast in suspension, but we want the protein and all the glossy bits in suspension. So we have fined hazies before, but usually we don't.
A lot of our beers, though, we do, just because it just makes them look that much prettier.
What's my favorite traditional hop in a whirlpool? Willamette.
Willamette.
Willamette's like a good balance of like... earthy, herbal, and subtly sweet.
It does work. I have used it before.
Yeah. I don't know. He said traditional hop. I don't know what you mean by traditional hop. You mean like Saz versus Hallertau versus Fuggles versus Goldings?
I'm so sorry. I am yawning like crazy.
Out of all those, I told you you'd be tired. You didn't take a big enough nap.
I didn't take any naps.
Yeah, you should take more naps.
Okay.
Do you do growler fills with kegs? Yeah. The easiest way to do that is if you're using like a corny keg, for example, you get your picnic faucet, if you have a picnic faucet, and you can actually attach the end of a racking cane to it or a bottle filler to it, and you can just fill with that under a little bit of pressure by putting a number 6.5 stopper over that racking cane. So you can kind of fake pressure filling.
Gotcha. So we got a message from Kendrick asking best beer styles to throw any kind of fruit at. First one that kind of comes to mind, well, is actually one that we have on, which is a Goza. So a kind of slightly sour style of beer. And then I would say a lot of like, you know, like French Saisons can benefit really nicely from fruit.
Depends on the fruit, really.
Wheat beers. A typical American wheat beer is always a good place to start if you want to throw some fruit at it.
Most of ours that we've done lately are sours and IPAs.
Yeah.
Four sour IPAs.
Yeah, and IPAs actually tend to work really well, depending on the fruit, I would say.
Milkshake IPAs.
You know, I don't know if you want to throw like a bunch of cantaloupe at a IPA, but that might come across weird. The world is your oyster. I wouldn't overthink it. I would just honestly go for it, and more than likely it's going to work out just fine. So just always keep in mind that fruit has a tendency to dry beer out instead of making it sweeter, which is the opposite of what a lot of people think.
At what pressure do you fill bottles from kegs? So you try to keep it at the proper serving pressure, actually. We just balance the lines like we would with line balancing. And then we make sure, first of all, that the bottle itself is cold, if possible, and also lubricated, meaning either at least wet, if not just freshly star sand. That'll lubricate it and it'll stop the foaming, meaning you're keeping most of the CO2 in the bottle, hopefully. I've been thinking during COVID to replace in-person events would be fun to organize beer swaps. Do these organizations already exist? Any experience? Would it be unsafe? So there are places that do beer swaps. Usually it's local community stuff. I've seen a lot of people doing it over Facebook, kind of like a door drop kind of situation.
Yeah.
That's kind of depend on your neighborhood.
I was going to say, that's going to depend on you. Everybody's kind of got their own thing going on with that right now. So, we got a few more. So only going to be able to answer a few more questions here. We do got to get open, but I see a commercial one here. Somebody is talking about doing a 3.5 barrel brew house, and you know how we feel about how we grow our system and going bigger. And I think I'll just kind of say the elephant in the room, which is buy the biggest system you can afford. ultimately, that can be expensive and get expensive really fast. I would actually buy a quality. I guess I take that back.
Yeah, buy the biggest quality system
you can afford.
Yeah, make sure that you're taking care of everything on the fermentation side first. And so if you can afford, for example, nice unitanks where you can pressure ferment, spunding valves, things like that, that makes your life a lot easier. Anything like a hop back or anything that's going to help you infuse flavors in line if you need to, maximize your hoppiness, not lose aromatics and flavor, all that stuff's super important. So glycol for your unitanks, get all the fermentation side done as cleanly as possible. That way, your life will be a lot easier. And
And then I would say when it comes to the brew house itself, you know, it's probably going to cost you more, but if you can, try to purchase a brew house that is sort of packaged as an all-in-one system versus trying to piece something together, just because people spend a lot of time to make those systems efficient. And when you're piecing something together, it's highly unlikely that you're going to be as efficient as a company that, you know, spent a lot of research, spent a lot of time and money to build the same thing.
In terms of how we felt, there was, I mean, there's always a learning curve when you're on a new system, even if you're experienced on systems. You got to think a little bit critically when it comes to if you're not getting the flavors you want, and don't be afraid to taste critically when you taste your beers. If you're not getting the flavors you want or if things aren't going right, dig in, make sure that you're like trying actively to troubleshoot and get better. Because I know a lot of people are like, oh, this is just what my beer tastes like on this system, and they think it tastes fine, and it doesn't. So don't get complacent. It's good. Can you use essential oils for aroma? You can, but be careful not to overdo it. It kind of depends on which one, but they can be pretty big. Oh. With hazies being all the rage, what styles would you like to see more of? Light lagers.
Always, yeah. Jim, full mash, batch barge, or fly sparge? Yes, all of the above. We'll have to get back to you on another stream for that one. That's kind of a long conversation in itself, right there.
It depends on your system.
Yeah.
For most people, batch barging is the easiest and most consistent to do. But that's a big topic.
As for Brandon, asking when the best time to add fruit is, always add it. Well, I shouldn't. We have a video on that, actually. Watch the video. Otherwise, when in doubt, add it to secondary. That's what I would say. If you want to get more flavor from it.
Someone bought a cannula. Nice.
There you go. Ooh.
Should you help? What is a smallish growler for?
All right. I think that's it. Corner. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Please smash that like button. This will conclude our live stream for this week. Join us next week at 8:45 Pacific Standard Time for another one. And
As for the oxygen free growler, I don't have a good answer to that, but they do make adapters for growlers to pressure fill. I would just say, as long as you're trying to transfer into any growler, try to make it as low oxygen as possible, and then it should be good. But yeah, hit the thumbs up button, everybody.
Thumbs up right now.
Subscribe to our channel. If you're not subscribed, subscribe. What are you doing?
Subscribe. All right, we really do have to get open now.
Yeah.